I just love seeing hummingbirds in my garden, and today we're going to talk about how to attract them. Hi, this is Jill Nadeau. I've been having fun filling in for Larry Mueller this week. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guest today is Mark Dwyer. He's the Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. And in addition to bringing in hummingbirds, we're going to chat about what's going on at the Rotary Gardens and, as always, take your gardening calls. Are you attracting hummingbirds? How are you doing it? What gardening questions do you have? Join our conversation. Our number, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can find us on Facebook by searching for The Larry Mueller Show. And Mark, it's always such a pleasure to have you here.
A pleasure to be here.
And you take the drive up all the way from Janesville.
Well, I love the trip, and an oddly kind of a rainy day today, but
it is. Well, how are things at the Rotary Gardens? We've had a lot of rain in this area. Have you also had a lot of rain?
Well, we like to use the word ample.
Ample.
You know, the gardens themselves. I have to say with the rain we've had this year, it's saved our watering bill. You know, we haven't had to run irrigation a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know it's out of our hands, but in essence, for us, I'd rather see a year like this than a real droughty year. So I think this will help recharge a lot of issues we've had with drier years, and there are some implications of a wetter year and some cooler temperatures, but in the grand scheme of things, we're pretty happy with it.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. So I'm sure gardeners are happy to hear that too, because they've had the same experience. Now, you have a number of specialty gardens each year, as well as your permanent gardens. Tell us about Hummingbird Haven.
Sure, you bet. And, you know, Jill, you're alluding to the gardens themselves. 40% of the gardens is different every year. The Hummingbird Haven is one of our seasonal themes, although we did it last year, and it was such a huge success, we replicated it this year. And this is in our children's garden. And the intent is specifically to attract hummingbirds. And, of course, it's a very ornamental garden. And for those that have gardened for hummingbirds or enjoyed hummingbirds in their yard, they've seen them flitting about, beautiful flowers. And our Hummingbird Haven right now, as we speak, is at peak. It's at summer peak, and we're seeing a lot more hummingbirds coming through, and that'll continue through the next 2 months. We'll see a lot of activity.
Well, what are the key elements to having a successful hummingbird garden?
Well, I think it's primarily with plant selection. I think understanding the hummingbirds themselves, the huge portion of their diet are insects. So typical gardens would provide some of that for hummingbirds. But for those that have incorporated feeders into their landscape or specific plants, I think it goes back to an appropriate plant selection to attract a wide number, a vast number of these birds coming through. So understanding their preferences.
And what are those? Share with us. We need to know. Plant names.
Well, let me rattle some off.
Okay.
Well, the garden themselves, you know, when you think of hummingbirds and them hovering and sipping nectar out of these plants, it's the trumpet-shaped blossoms is the important thing. So when you think of a lot of our standard garden perennials, things like penstemons or daylilies, coral bells that even have little trumpety flowers are great for hummingbirds. Our focus in the Hummingbird Haven, we do have lots of flowers, perennial flowers, but lots of seasonal plants, things like zinnias, flowering tobacco, lots and lots of salvias. And for those that have grown any type of salvia, the flower architecture is very trumpet-shaped. There's a central spire and a lot of trumpets coming off, whether, again, it's a perennial or an annual. And with 2 years under our belt of doing this garden, we were observing last year that the salvias were an absolute slam dunk and seemed to be preferred by these hummingbirds. But our garden has almost 100 varieties of plants for hummingbirds, and we're really kind of seeing what they prefer.
Oh, that's great. Now, you also said that you had feeders, correct?
We used feeders last year.
Okay.
And there's nothing wrong with doing that, but we were real interested to see what sort of population would come through without the use of feeders. You know, feeders is a separate topic, and I think it's important to mention that when they're properly placed and utilized, you will see activity, because that sugar water, in essence, that nectar will be of interest to those hummingbirds. Unfortunately, what I see a lot of are neglected feeders that have been left out, where there's mildew issues, there's fungal problems, the water's been out there for weeks or even months, and there's been no cleaning of those feeders, and that's very dangerous. And there's also a lot of commentary back and forth, and you and I were talking about this,
right?
the dye, the red coloring. The red is not essential at all. In fact, I think some current research is showing some issues with the dyes, and so why even bother with that?
But really, if you can get them there with the flowers, then you don't need the feeder, right?
Well, we had some expert hummingbird folks come to the gardens last year, and they seem pretty interested in promoting feeders, and I understood.
Okay.
And they had a two-acre property where they had feeders throughout, and they maintained them well, and they saw a lot of activity. I feel that our garden is so specifically flower-heavy for hummingbirds. We're real interested, again, in seeing them go for these plants. And it's amazing seeing the number of photographers out there with tripods.
Oh.
And people that can capture a hummingbird photo, I have a lot of respect for. It's very difficult. And they're doing it. We're seeing a lot of that activity.
Our guest today is Mark Dwyer. He's the director of horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens. Do you have a question about hummingbird attraction or gardening in general? Well, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, and let's go to the phone. We've got Mike in La Crosse with a question on hummingbirds. Hi, Mike.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is what I've observed and is that, well, primarily to attract hummingbirds, I've got bee balm and I've got trumpet vines and some miscellaneous other things, but those are the dominant things. And right now over about a 75-foot area, I have about 4 hummingbird feeders out, and I get hummingbirds around there pretty regular. They've been working the bee balm real hard, as well as the bumblebees, but it seems like there's territorial issues. You'll have a hummingbird come to a feeder, and then there'll be another one come swooping down and chase it off, and they go zipping off a couple of yards. You can see them if you can follow them a couple of yards north or south, and I'm wondering what that is, and if there's I also visited places, for instance, like Hummingbird Sanctuary outside of Sierra Vista, Arizona, where they have multiple feeders, and there's just, you know, one hummingbird after another coming to the feeders, and I have never observed anything places like that where there's a dominant, what seems to be a dominant bird chasing some of the others away.
Okay,
and
thank you.
I'll take your comments off air.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Have you seen any of that territorial type of behavior in the gardens at all, Mark?
We have, and I think it's important to mention, Mike also gave us 2 other great plants for hummingbirds, Monarda, any of the Monardas. The bee balms are excellent. The trumpet vine is good. The territoriality is an issue for sure, and we've seen it in our garden. Excuse me. And one of the real issues with it is we can't do anything about it. And in the past, last year, we had hummingbird feeders spaced throughout the gardens. We had 6 of them. And we're talking only about a space that's a third to half an acre. And the intent was to kind of distribute the feeders. But what we're seeing is we had so many flowers that these issues weren't prevalent. But it was interesting when guests would see these hummingbirds chasing each other. And hummingbirds can get extremely mean.
Yes.
And this territory thing, they will fight for space. And again, there's very little we can do about it. Our hope is we're providing enough opportunity where they all will share. but as you can imagine, there's real, and to my knowledge, not a real good way in a space like that to deal with that.
It's nature. Okay, well, thank you very much for that call. Let's go to Mary in La Crosse. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have been anxiously awaiting someone who can answer this mystery for me. This year I planted, I'm in an apartment, but I have a lot of containers, and I planted it mostly for bee pollinators, but also to attract hummingbirds and butterflies. But there was a purple petunia that I could not resist that was in every garden center I saw last spring. It was purple, and it had speckles on it. And so I bought and have a hanging basket of it. And then after having it for about 2 weeks, one day I thought, it's turning white. And within a short period of time, it was almost daily. You could see it changing. And it got pure white with just a deep purple center. And I went over to the garden center where I bought it, and lo and behold, they had a whole bunch of them, and they were all white. And I asked the owner, and he didn't know the answer, but they said they would call me back. And so then it started changing where it turned purple in kind of the peaks of the petunia. And by the way, it's called mounding petunia, night sky. And it was grown by WGH in Minneapolis, and it says on it, key to success, do not over dry. Trim back is needed to keep full. Speckle colored pattern is unstable in certain conditions. So then it started a different pattern, And twice now, it's gone back to the speckle pattern. But I have been amazed to watch it all summer and wondered, what in the world, how did they hybridize? Was it a sport? And what is making it change these colors all summer?
Okay. Well, Mark, do you have that answer for her?
Well, I've had some experience with night sky, and before Mary mentioned the variety name, I knew exactly what she was talking about. And Mary, the issue specifically with night sky, there's now a variety called pink sky, which is very similar, pink with the white speckles, is that it's not stable. These are produced vegetatively. They're not from seed. So 5-6 years ago, they came across this speckled petunia, and it was promoted heavily about 3 years ago, and I'm not impressed with it for all the reasons you just mentioned, it because it's being promoted as this beautiful speckled petunia, but the variability, and I'm sure you've seen flowers that are totally blue, totally white, little bit of speckling, half white, striped blue. We've grown it in baskets and containers, and the issue is I just don't feel that it's able to, you know...
Live up to its word.
Live up to it, right. I'm searching for the word here, yeah. But it's simply not stable. And having said that, a lot of the modern petunias that are vegetatively offered, you'll see a change in color through the season based on temperature. The watering is a factor. A lot of the current reds and oranges have some issues. But ultimately, they are great for hummingbirds. But I think it's going to be a tough sell on those speckled ones in the future until they get them stabilized.
So maybe they should market it as a petunia of many colors. And they'll be true to form, right?
There you go.
Okay. Thank you for your call, Mary. Appreciate that. Gary in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Gary.
Yes, hi. Okay, we've got a couple of feeders in northern Wisconsin, and I got problems with ants constantly going in the feeders and eventually drowning in the feeders. They're in the liquid, and I think that's cutting down on my visits by the birds themselves. I'm wondering if there's any way to keep them out of there.
Mark, do you have any problems with ants?
We do, and you know, a lot of hummingbirds come with, you know, the little portals where the birds will get the nectar. There's many have devices called ant guards, which to me are ineffective. They're kind of a yellow mesh typically, and will supposedly block ants, but they're ants, if they're interested enough in getting in there, they will. And Gary, you're right. Once ants get in there and die and create an issue, it's very unappetizing to the birds, hence the sterilization. What we found with our feeders was when we would clean them, and we would actually empty and clean our feeders every week, which is, some people will say that's overkill, but our intent was to sterilize them, put fresh nectar. We would mix our own. I'm not going to remember the recipe offhand, but once we filled them, we made sure there was no additional residue on the exterior of the feeder, because usually if there's anything sticky on the outside, that'll really bring them in. So aside from being vigilant and trying to keep them off and keeping a clean feeder, the battle with the ants is near impossible.
All right. Thank you for that call, Gary. We appreciate it. Well, let's go to Michael in West Allis. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
What do you have for us?
I have a comment about the territorial issue with the feeders. When we were bringing in the hummingbirds, quickly realized that one dominant male hummingbird will take over a multi-port feeder that's got more nectar in it than he could possibly drink in a lifetime. But he will obviously defend all comers. And the quick anecdotal story about that, I noticed that, again, this dominant male fogging the whole feeder, nobody else can get a drink. A coalition of three females got together, and in cooperation, one of them would go out to the feeder and encourage the male to chase her away. Then her two sisters would come and drink, and they would take turns that way of which of the females lured away the dominant male so they could actually eat. But anyway, as far as this territorial issue, I found to avoid multi-port liquid feeders, and that using the smallest, which are also the cheapest and easiest to keep clean because it's holding a lesser volume of the nectar, that if you use single-port feeders and spread them around, that it really knocks down a lot of that territorial fighting.
Oh, great. Thank you, Michael. Thanks for sharing that story, especially, and with the bird, the feeders. With the, does that make sense, Mark, to it, just have the one?
It makes a lot of sense, mm-hmm. and it doesn't surprise me that the male would be so easily duped.
Me either.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. We've been talking with Mark Dwyer. He's the Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. How's your garden doing? Need any suggestions or tips? Well, give us a call 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, it's time to take a look at lawn care. It's getting real close to the best time to reseed and repair, and our guest will help you out with any questions that you may have. That's next week right here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking gardens with Mark Dwyer. Mark, you know, this time of year, my garden is looking a little, there's a lot of perennials, so it's looking a little sad. Mm-hmm. What are some good suggestions for August, September perennials that I could put in my garden?
Sure. You know, and it's one of those things as we examine our gardens through the years, it's important to see when we have those gaps. And we consider there's typically a June gap, a separation from our spring bulbs to our earlier perennials, and then this August gap that you mentioned. So, you know, as our daylilies are our past peak and finishing off, with the exception of some blue, rebloomers, we start to lean very heavily on things like helenium, or Helen's flower, that's starting up nicely. There's a lot of perennial rudbeckias that are still blooming strong.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Russian sage is really starting to show a lot of color. There's some great opportunities, you know, in terms of long blooming perennials. When we think about dedicating a certain piece of real estate in our garden to perennials or any type of plant, we want the most bang for the buck and the longest portion of interest. We're leaning heavily on garden phlox for a lot of reasons. Garden phlox have been blooming for a couple weeks now, and they'll go at least another 4 to 6 weeks, offering fragrance and, you know, beauty. And there's also some wonderful variegated forms. So when you're selecting perennials for late season color, keep in mind that color can also be provided by foliage, in addition to the flowers or in lieu of, that might be the primary feature of interest. So extending color through the garden throughout the entire growing season is that combination of flowers and foliage. But the trick is real heat-tolerant perennials that'll do well late in the season. So the list goes on and on, but ultimately we're seeing our hope is to segue from our August perennials into those late bloomers in September into early October.
And you said right now that your gardens are peak right now.
We are at peak, definitely with our seasonal plants. We plant about 150,000 annuals every year, so that lends itself to a lot of our color themes and our different approaches. We also have about 3,000 varieties of perennials. So if folks want to see, you know, some things that are doing real well, you know, we talked about rudbeckias and Helen's flowers, things like Shasta daisies. There's just so many things that are blooming at peak right now. And that ample water we discussed earlier certainly has helped things look very robust this year.
Definitely. And that's a good thing to bring up, too. If you have questions, go to a botanical garden. There's quite a few of them around the state. They're sprinkled around. People can visit. You get really good ideas.
Absolutely. And, you know, see what the neighbors are doing. It's one of those things where, as you observe good plants, I always encourage people to have a camera of any sort and take some photos and remember what you've seen.
And it's pretty easy with cell phones these days. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones. We have, oh, they're all filled. So let's go to Becky in Rio. Hi, Becky.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We can. What's your question?
Great. Well, I don't have a question as much as a story. Right now, we're all battling Japanese beetles so much. And last Friday, I was judging at the Eau Claire County Fair, and I was judging 4-H food preservation, of all things, and one of the exhibits was dried Japanese beetles.
To
I
eat?
I couldn't believe it.
To eat? Is that what you're...
No, well, for someone to eat. It was not face-to-face judging, so I didn't get a chance to talk to the youth, but he had written a card and attached it to his entry. He caught the beetles. He killed them overnight in a plastic bag, and then he spread them on a sheet and dried them in the oven, and he's feeding them to his pet turtle instead of buying live crickets.
Oh.
It was such an ingenious idea. It made me laugh, but I really wish I could have talked to him because I had a couple questions I would have liked to know more about. First of all, did he ask the turtle? Does the turtle want to
Does the turtle want to eat those?
Yeah, these beetles. I'd like to know if he tried them. And because he plans on doing this in the winter when he can't catch live crickets. And I wanted to know, how bad did his kitchen stink when he was drying them?
Well, that is ingenious. So maybe you can start a business there, Mark, to sell dry Japanese beetles.
It is a bumper crop this year. I mean, it's not the most I've seen for us at the gardens, but we got used to seeing a very small population, but now this year's pretty heavy.
Well, our bug people say that they kind of go in...
Yeah,
trends, cycles. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, mm-hmm. Cycles. So thank you for sharing that with us, Becky. Appreciate that. Let's go to Randy, who is near Sparta. Can we get to that, Dave? No, we got a little bit of a problem there. So, and we've had phone problems all week. So we did have a caller who couldn't stay with us. He says if you use a tree tanglefoot insect barrier, you can keep ants out of your hummingbird feeder. He also has a question about what are the primary insects that hummingbirds like to eat? Well, you're not a bird expert, Mark, but do you know?
I really don't, but I think it constitutes more than 50% of their diet. Mm-hmm. And so a healthy garden would have ample insects, and that's part of the reason they're moving around so fast. They're nibbling those, but interesting approach with that insect barrier to keep those ants out of the feeder.
Okay, and we can get to Randy now. He's near Sparta. Randy, you have a tip for us.
Okay, what I did for the ant problem, I got a rod. It's a rod that... like hummingbird feeders hang off of, and I greased them. I greased about 3-4 feet off the ground. I just greased it, and all I do is collect ants on my rod and no ants in the hummingbird feeders.
Wow.
More hummingbirds. I could sell them by the dozen. I got two feeders. I've had two birds in each hole. At one time, I had 5 holes in my feeder, and I had 2 birds in each hole. I had 10 birds. I got that male, that boy that he's mean. He chases them around. And
okay, well, thank you, Randy. That sounds like you've got quite the hummingbird forest going on there. But that makes sense.
Sure does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you for sharing that, Randy. Let's go to Linda. Northwoods, I think she is in Northwoods. I'm assuming that's a city. Is that right, Linda?
Well, actually, it's at our cabin in the Northwoods.
In the Northwoods. Okay, where about?
Well, it's a little town called Cayuga.
Okay.
South of Mellon, Wisconsin.
Sure, got to give a shout out to your town. Yes. What's your question?
Well, this spring, we had a couple thunderstorms roll through, and in between the storms, we had about 40 to 50 hummingbirds at our feeder. All at once, and they stayed for about maybe a half an hour, and then they were gone. And I was wondering if this is an oddity or something that happens.
Well, again, Linda, you know, Mark is not a bird expert, but I think that we've talked about birds in the past where they maybe are migrating, or if there was a storm, maybe they just got a little confused or something.
Well, and if they were visiting the feeder, they could have been bulking up for energy because, you know, storm or wind currents, the amount of energy a hummingbird expends is unbelievable. So I think that feeder would become more important if there was issues of poor weather.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, thanks for sharing that with us, Linda. You've got a lot of different gardens in the Rotary Garden, so they're all made up of little ones. What are some of your favorites? Which ones do you really look forward to seeing every year?
Well, you know, our 20-acre garden, and we're going on our 29th year of history here.
Wow.
You're right on that it's separated into 26 garden areas. And we have thematic gardens, like English cottage garden, French formal garden. One of my favorite thematic gardens is our Japanese garden, which is real beautiful in terms of style, in terms of coloration, really a sharp garden. And when our visitors go through the gardens, we've heard it many times over that it's a sort of a sequence of not only spaces but experiences. So the Japanese garden, I think, is dynamite. I think our shade garden is real nice. As a young garden, we were fortunate to have a lot of existing shade trees, so we can demonstrate plants for part shade and deep shade. But I'm a huge fan of our gardens that change over every year. So,
right.
You know, we talked about our hummingbird haven, but this year we also have an heirloom garden. It's all plants and vegetables that were pre-1900 selections, and a lot of different color themes as well, including a long planted wall with all fragrant plants for people to enjoy. So our focus on the senses has been something very prevalent for us as well.
And what in the wintertime, is that how you spend your time, figuring out what you're going to do next spring?
I wish I had more time to do that. I think many folks know that we also have a massive light show. And our holiday light show, we start setting that up in less than a month.
Oh, my goodness.
So my fall activity is running 6 miles of extension cords. So I get about a month in winter to figure things out for spring, but we also have to take this show down. And anyway, it's a great way to bring people to the gardens in winter.
I would imagine. Yeah. Now, is that free?
No, it's a fundraiser, so we do charge, and we see 30,000 to 40,000 people a year. It's in December.
My goodness.
It's all on our website. There's pictures of previous years, but it's a walk-through experience. You actually walk through the gardens, and it's about 400,000 lights and displays and themes.
It sounds wonderful. Yeah. Why don't you give us your website right away?
Sure. Yeah, it's www.rotarygardens.org.
Okay, excellent. Well, go there. You've got some really pretty pictures, and it gives you all the information. I think we can... We still can't go to those phones. I'm not... Okay, all right. All right, well, we were talking about events, and you said you have a few coming up soon.
Yeah,
not just the lights, but there's others.
Right,
yeah.
Right. In August, we see it's the last of our music series on August 15th, and all of this is, again, on our website. And I think I misspoke. I need to mention, I think it was rotarybotanicalgardens.org.
Okay. But if you Google it, you're going to
Google
find
it up, and you'll find it. So we have a music series. Again, our last installment of that is on August 15th. We're heading into early September, where we have our massive fall plant sale. And that's the weekend of the 8th, 9th, and 10th.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of activity selling perennials and shrubs and mums. And these are all fundraisers for the gardens. It's important to mention we are a nonprofit, and our mission is strictly education. That's why we were founded. So we do rely on these events and admissions and memberships and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're heading into a real busy season here.
Okay. All right. So we can finally go back to the phones. Yay. We've got Janie in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Janie.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question or comment?
It's just a cute story from some years ago. Mom and Dad had a big garden, a lot of flowers, a lot of vegetables, and Mom was out working with her clematis vine, which, of course, had grown quite high. And she was kind of bent over with her head in the clematis vine, and something attacked her head and got caught her hair and did a she thought it was a giant bee, and it was a hummingbird, and he or she was furious and just really, really got after Mom. So it was just a cute story about a hummingbird.
It is. You know, I've heard that actually from someone else, too. They thought this bug was bothering them, you know, dive bombing their head in the garden, and it was a hummingbird. So, yeah. Have you had any guests at the gardens that have gotten kind of tangled up with hummingbirds at all?
They sort of do these flybys. They'll buzz right by your ear, and if you've never heard a hummingbird whiz by you, it's an interesting sound.
It is.
Because they're fast.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting. The clematis is a perennial vine that attracts hummingbirds, so I imagine that hummingbird was... upset that Mom was in the way there.
Getting in his business. So, you were talking about the fragrant garden. What are some of the flowers that you like to have for that particular garden?
Well, you know, we include a lot of the typical herbs. And when you think of fragrance in the garden, there's two ways it's received. Either tactile, like imagine rubbing basil or rosemary,
right. Mm-hmm.
Where you smell your fingers,
mm-hmm.
Or emission. Things like lilacs and fragrant viburnums. We have a lot of lilies and fragrant perennials in there, but I'm real excited about some of our seasonal plants where all our visitors can enjoy, for instance, the smell of chocolate provided by Chocolate Cosmos and Chocolate Daisy. Again, both are annuals.
Mm-hmm.
We have an interesting tropical plant called a popcorn plant or popcorn cassia, and it literally smells like buttered popcorn. But people can enjoy the scents of vanilla from fragrant heliotrope. We have just about every scent you can imagine, and many that emit scent at dusk. And keep in mind, fragrance was never really developed in plants for humans. It's mm-hmm. meant to either attract pollinators with scent, or in many cases, those herbs, it's the essential oils, are meant to deter insect damage in the leaves. So, but it's great to incorporate fragrance, and it's typically underdone in our gardens, and I think we can really maximize it with good plant selection.
And they've kind of been bred out in the past few decades or so, haven't they? The smell has not been top of the list of things to have in a plant. But is that kind of coming back a little bit?
It is coming back, but that's a great point because I mentioned fragrant heliotrope. For many years, the newest heliotropes had no fragrance, and that's really the reason you would buy them. Flowering tobaccos, there's many that have no scent. So if you're going for a traditional plant you think should have scent, do a little more research and make sure it is truly one that does and when that scent is emitted.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones again. We've got Tony calling from Clintonville. Hi, Tony. What do you have for us?
Hi. I just have a quick little, I guess, change on the territorial part of the hummingbirds. While my husband and I lived in Flagstaff, Arizona, we had a townhouse, and in that townhouse we developed what we registered as an urban wildlife habitat. So we included a little pond with a waterfall, and we had honeysuckle and climbing roses and all different types of plants and flowers that would attract both butterflies and then hummingbirds and other animals and things. And we put a feeder on the back fence for peanuts for the squirrels and the blue jays. But we noticed with the hummingbird feeder, we had a couple of them, and one of them was really large. It had, I think it was 8 different places where the hummingbirds could feed. And it was almost like what I called an airport. We would have 30 hummingbirds hanging around, and they'd be in rings above each other and going outwards away from the hummingbird feeder, and every part of it would be have a hummingbird sitting on it, and then there'd be a ring that would be just a further out and then another one further out, and as one left the feeder it would go out to the outer ring and hover while the other one went in then to feed, and it was constantly going back and forth changing, but they just hovered there. And I've never seen that before in any other place that we've lived. They've always been more territorial where they only allow one to feed. But we thought that was really interesting to see how it, like I said, it was almost like a little airport where they were just kind of hovering and waiting for a chance to feed, and there wasn't any fighting at all. So we thought that was pretty interesting.
Okay, well, great. Thanks, Tony. Thanks for the story. You just never know, right? You just never know. So let's go to Ron in Abrams. He's got a question. Hi, Ron.
Good morning. I'm surprised that your expert doesn't know about this because we've been using it for years. It's an ant trap that hangs in between the feeder and the shepherd hook. It's about 2 inches deep, 1.5 inches across, and it has a post in the middle that it hangs from, and you fill that half with water, and the ants die in there. They crawl in there and can't get out.
Okay. Well, thanks for the information, Ron. And again, Mark is not a bird expert, so it's not necessarily his area to know about the ant traps. We'll forgive you for that, Mark.
Well, this is great dialogue. It's great to hear all these ideas, and I think this will be excellent for the listeners.
There you go. Thanks. All right. Up next, we got another hummingbird comment, Darlene in Viola. Hi, Darlene.
Hello. I have tried several different hummingbird feeders in the past and also Baltimore Oriole feeders, and I found one by a company called Aspect, A-S-P-E-C-T. They are very reasonable in price, very high quality construction, and there is a built-in ant moat, and I have never had problems with ants. And they're very easy to clean, very, very good construction. Number one. Number two, I keep my bird feeders out of the sun in shade. The birds will find them because the sun will certainly contribute to all those nasties in the water. And number three, the type of sugar that I use is pure cane sugar, not the cheap sugar that is GMO oriented. So word to the wise, if we're not going to be ingesting the GMOs, why should our birds? Thank you.
Well, thank you, Darlene. Well, let's switch topics a little bit and talk to Marion in Madison. Hi, Marion. What's your question?
Hello.
Hi, Marion.
I have a tomato question.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I have several varieties of tomatoes in my yard, but and they're mostly doing very well. I have two beefsteak tomatoes that are in a relatively new lasagna garden, and they're right next to each other, like about 3 feet apart. One of them is loaded with tomatoes, and the other one is all foliage. There are one tiny group of 3 tomatoes, and it's almost buried in the center of the plant, and this is just overflowing with foliage. You can't even look through it. It's so dense. My two questions are, why did this happen? And two, if I went in and cut out half of the foliage, would it start producing flowers?
Well, are you a believer in taking out those suckers, Mark?
Yeah, that's a tough one. It could be a couple different things. The fact that, you know, usually with tomatoes we hear issues of low vigor, and in this case, this other beefsteak tomato is exceptional vigor and probably at the expense of flower production and fruit production. So I think it would be worth a try to thin the foliage. If you haven't seen a lot of blooms, you mentioned a little cluster of blooms and a couple of fruits at this point, but ultimately the season's going to get pretty late here, so I think you'd want to try that pretty soon. I'm assuming your soil's similar, but there's something going on with that more vigorous tomato where it's expending energy into foliar production as opposed to fruiting. And again, that could be some other issue. So I'd hate to speculate, but I think your theory is sound to give that a whirl and see if that helps out.
Okay, good luck, Marion. Appreciate the call. Next up, we have Robin in Portage. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
What's your question?
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I have a comment, first of all, about the hummingbird food. I've got a recipe. If someone else called in with one.
No, you can go ahead and
okay.
say.
Well, it's real simple. It's just then this will fill two feeders. So then you'll have to do the math after that. But it's just 1 cup of sugar and then 4 cups of water. And you stir them together, and then I bring them not even hardly to a full boil, but just so I see bubbles on the bottom of the pan, and let it totally cool. And as was suggested, clean your feeders once a week. That does the trick. Even if you get a few ants in there, the hummingbirds don't mind.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Robin. And what was your other question?
My question was, I have a trumpet vine, and now for the last 2 years, the majority, even more this year, I have more blooms, but the blooms are splitting. Do you know why?
I've never heard that problem with trumpet vine. What do you mean by splitting? Are they literally kind of shattering and falling apart?
No, they get, it's just like someone put an before they bloom, it's like someone took a knife and slit it from the base, not all the way up to the end where the blossom would come out,
mm-hmm.
or the, you know, the trumpet part of it. You know what I mean?
I'm visualizing it. I've never heard of that issue. I wonder if it's an insect doing that. It might be worth taking a sample to an extension agent or taking a photo and sending it off, because I get the feeling you're probably not the only one who's ever experienced this, but I don't personally have an idea, to be honest.
I think that's a great idea, Robin. You know, go to your extension office, send a picture. They'll be able to help you. I'm sure they've probably seen it already, so that hopefully that will help you out. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau, and I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. And we're talking with Mark Dwyer. He's the Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. How is your garden doing? Do you need any suggestions or tips? Well, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, we hope you can join us on Monday. We're going to have computer specialist Peter Green back with us. He'll have some tips on how to properly clean your computer equipment and, of course, take your calls. And that's Monday at 11. Right now, we are talking with Mike Dwyer from the Janesville Botanical Gardens. And we're going to go right back to the phones. And up next is Doug in Madison. Hi, Doug. What can we help you with?
Hi. Yeah, good show. Just tuned in here a little bit ago. First, a comment and a question. I switched my hummingbird feeder over to a fishing line hanging from a tree branch, and I don't know, that seemed to alleviate some of the ant problems. And my question is, I have some milkweed in my backyard, and I forget the name, I looked it up, but anyway, I have these little furry black, orange, and white caterpillars, some sort of moth that are just eating them up, and they're really cute, and I don't mind if they do that unless they're invasive, and I'm just kind of curious what they are and if I should just live and let live or get them off the milkweed.
What's your suggestion, Mark?
Well, I'm not sure what they are, so I think the first step, Doug, would be to get a positive ID from an entomologist or someone, you know, snap a photo and send it off and see what it is. We've seen some crazy insect populations this year as a result of a mild winter last year and then a lot of wetness. So it could be a condition of the type of year we're having. And, you know, the big question is if your milkweed is there to provide for monarchs or you have another interest in terms of insect activity, you'd want to know if there's something you need to do for those. But again, offhand, I'm not sure what those are, but it sounds like they're really denuding the foliage, and that could have an impact on your milkweed if they're really tearing it up.
Okay, and Doug, you can always contact the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW. You can find their contact information on the internet and send them a really good close-up picture, and I'm sure they'll be able to help you with that right away. Next, we're going to go to Irv in Marshall. Hi, Irv.
Hi.
What do you have for us?
Well, I have about 100 tomato plants, and I've always had pretty good luck with tomatoes and everything, but I do end up sooner or later getting a blight. But this year, it is just something terrible. It just started with just a few branches browning up, and then next thing you know, it's gone through the whole darn patch. And, I mean, what the heck can a person do? I'm not getting the nice. Last year I had the most perfect tomatoes you ever wanted to see. They're just absolutely nice. I sell tomatoes, and this year so far the ones that I've picked, I haven't found any that that I'd even want to sell. But it's just sickening to see the plant, which are 5 feet tall, and just dry right up like nothing. This doggone blight.
Have you had experience with that, Mark?
Yeah, I wish I had some good advice. The blight, of course, is one of the conditions or inputs, of course, is the weather. And having a damp year doesn't help anything. And I can commiserate with Irv because we, at Rotary Gardens years ago, we had a massive heirloom tomato collection. And it was about 150 varieties of heirlooms. And they were all 3 to 5 feet tall, nicely staked, beautiful fruits. And what Irv described as the symptoms, you see a little browning, a little wilting, and you're like, huh, that's interesting. And within 3 days, you know something really bad is happening. And those plants we removed within a week and had to dispose of them. And that blight works that fast. And there's a couple different blights, but I don't have any good advice on how to avoid that or, you know, what to do about it. Once you see it, it's too late for the most part. So, again, maybe Extension has a little more advice for you, because if you're selling tomatoes, that's a hit for you to lose that crop. So
it certainly is. Yeah. That's devastating. Sorry about that, Irv. I hope you can find some help with that. Jan in Madison is up next. Hi, Jan. What can we help you with?
Hi. We have a mountain ash. It's about 8 years old and very, very healthy right next to our back porch. This year with the rains, it's just got so much abundant fruit. It's completely bent over. It's actually bent the trunk. And I'm wondering if, one, it's going to be permanently disfigured. Two, whether I should, what we could do. Should we, get an arborist to stake it up, or should I take some of the fruit off? It's really bent over, and it's encroaching on the porch as well.
Ooh, what should she do?
Well, it's interesting, Jan. Usually I get calls about mountain ash and how they're performing poorly. And on a year like this, they can get a lot of foliage diseases and other things. So the fact that you have a bumper crop of fruits, it is a concern because of the weight. I wouldn't try to stake up individual branches with that fruit weight simply because what you're going to do is create some breaking points with however you stake it. I don't know that you need an arborist, but if you have a way to remove some of the fruit, I think you hit the nail on the head, the fact that having so much moisture, the fruit weight is probably a record. You may never see something like this again. But ultimately, you don't want to, if you're going to remove fruit, just be real, obviously gentle about it and very and systematic. And you'll see, even taking off a portion of that fruit, you'll start to see those branches start bending back. So I really don't think you'll see a permanent disfiguration. And ultimately, later in the season is the hope that some of the birds start getting at some of that, which unfortunately happens very late into the winter. But sounds like a healthy plant.
That's one good thing. Thanks for the call, Jan. Let's go to Joe in Greendale. Hi, Joe.
Hi, just a quick question about the garden phlox. I have beautiful pink ones that I look out when I'm doing dishes, and they're starting to, the flowerets are starting to fall and fade a little bit. Is it okay now to cut back? To get more, or I don't know, not too good with this stuff. Thanks.
Sure. Well, it's okay to cut. That's a personal decision. If they're looking a little ratty or spent and you want to deadhead or remove the blooms, that's okay. You may get some additional blooms coming up, but as we head later in the season, ultimately, they'll be real sporadic. The great thing about garden phlox is having about a two-month bloom time, which I think you know, and they're just great for a wide range of pollinators, and that fragrance is excellent. But, you know, back to your original question, the best time to cut is when you feel you need to, you know, because you're not going to hurt that plant at all.
So should you just take the flower head off, or should she be actually cutting it down further?
Oh, I wouldn't cut it down further. I should clarify that. If you want to remove the flowers because they're turning brown, that's okay. We don't cut any of our garden phlox at all until hard frost. Then we cut them down. If you were to cut it down now, if that was your interest, you would see regrowth that would be subject to frost. You'd have some new growth that probably would be damaged in October.
Okay, well, keep enjoying those, Joe. Let's see. Nancy in La Crosse is up next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, thank you for your guest today. I have a native prairie about maybe 70 yards long, and I wanted to introduce a couple more things this fall. And I had a question about New Jersey tea. I mean, it's listed as something that draws hummingbirds, but I've never seen it growing, and I wasn't sure. Do you have experience with it, and what kind of plant bush is it?
Well, it is a great native plant. Oddly enough, about an hour and a half ago, I saw one on the UW-Madison campus here. It was in the botany garden, and the Latin is Ceanothus. It's a great plant for a wide range of pollinators that you mentioned. We currently don't have any at Rotary Botanical Gardens, but you should know it is a woody plant, so it's a smaller to medium-sized shrub. Likes good drainage, but would be a great addition to any sort of pollinator garden. My only concern with it is in our harshest of winters, you may see some dieback. Depending on where you are in the state, in La Crosse, you might be okay, but I think a little more research on its hardiness and proper placement to get it established.
Okay. Well, good luck, Nancy. Hope that works for you. Our next call is from Ryan in Brilliant. Hi, Ryan.
Hello. How are you?
Well, thanks. What's your question or comment for us?
I was wondering, my wife and I are looking to put in about 800 to 1,000 square feet of milkweed garden and native plants right behind our house. But unfortunately, it's on the north side of the house. And so a lot of it will get full sun, but there will be some that's right tight against the house that is going to be in shade or very shaded. And was wondering if we had any ideas on things that would be both tall, because it's going to be in the back, and also shout tolerant of the shade. That would be good for pollinators and for hummingbirds, and that might fit into that spot.
Well, great question, Ryan. You know, the issue with shade is, number one, to determine the degree of shade, because ultimately, you know, is it dappled sun that's coming through a tree canopy? Is it shade that's just provided by the structure? Determining how much light you're actually getting in that space will dictate a lot of the plant selection. But as you get into native plants, you really start getting limited with taller plants in the shade. Now, there's some that are part shade tolerant, things like Simisifuga. It's now called Actaea. This is fairy candle or snake root. It's been blooming for us for almost 2 months, has beautiful, fragrant white blossoms, lots of pollinators. There are some non-native species, though, so you really need to know what you're getting into. Ultimately, with some of the, again, these shade perennials, it's important to understand, again, the soil as well. In our shade garden, one of our challenges is not just considering the lighting, it's considering area roots, what other trees are competing for resources. And I have to say, if you're ever able to visit the Madison area, I think Olbrich Botanical Gardens has done a wonderful job with their shade gardens, including a lot of natives and understory woody plants. And they're dabbling with a lot of these native sedges. They're not true grasses, but there's a lot of sedges that'll take a lot of shade and be a very effective ground cover. So it's a tough, dynamic topic, and it's a question I get a lot, but it can be done. But I think the most important thing is knowing your site and then going from there.
Okay. And I think we have time to talk to Karen here in Madison. Hi, Karen. Karen,
Hi.
Are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh. What's up?
Well, I was going to offer a suggestion to the tomato person. I had 2 years in a row where my beautiful production of tomatoes went downhill really quickly, and I finally took part of it into Dr. Death at the Plant Diagnostic Lab, Brian Huddleston, and learned it was bacterial, not blight. and it was in the soil. So once it was in the soil, until I removed the soil and put in new soil, it was going to keep coming back. But it just destroyed my tomatoes. And this year, they're beautiful.
Oh, well, that's kind of good news, I guess, Karen. You think that's a good idea, Mark?
I think so, and I think Karen's alluding to Irv's comments. And if you do have tomatoes that looks like a blight, a soil test can help determine specifically what the issue is, and you can go from there. And I think Karen brings up a great point.
And Brian Huddleston is a person that you want to talk to over there, or actually you can just Google again for the Disease Diagnostic Center at UW. Well, we are talking with Mark Dwyer. He's the director of horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. If you haven't visited or you haven't visited in a while, check it out. There's lots of great gardening going on there, and there's lots of great things to check out on the Ideas Network. So stay with us. It's Friday, so it must be time to talk about gardening on the Larry Mueller Show. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry. Our guest is Mark Dwyer. He's the director of horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Mark has degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry, and he's happy to answer your gardening questions. How's your garden looking? Do you have problems? What questions do you have for Mark? Join the conversation. All of our lines are open. 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. And you can post on our Facebook page. You can find that at The Larry Mueller Show. And always like to look at gardening pictures. And we did have a caller who couldn't stay on the line with us earlier, but wanted to pass on that with regard to the caller about trumpet vine, that orioles will pierce the trumpet vine flowers. So could that have been the cause of that, do you think, Mark?
That's interesting. It sounded like it was a critter, and I had suggested maybe it was an insect, but I'm going to check on that later. That sounds like a valid theory, and very curious that was occurring.
Yeah, so they might be going in for whatever's inside, right? The sweetness?
That could be.
Yeah, that could be. And we also had a question from Mary on Facebook, and she was wondering if you could explain sterilize when you were talking about cleaning the hummingbird feeders. She wanted to know, is it more than just washing out the bottle and putting fresh water, sugar water in it? She was wondering, what do you do?
I think folks do a lot of different things, and we might be doing something that would be considered overkill, but our approach and our feeders, I should describe, were glass-topped and plastic-bottom. There's so many different styles out there. But what we would do is separate the pieces, and we would actually put the glass in boiling water. We would do a boil to clear it off. And again, it's important to clean every portion of all the surfaces. The plastic, we would clean with a 1 to 10 bleach to water solution and then really get it rinsed off well. We'd actually take a toothbrush and clean up any of the ant guards and just in anything that looked like mildew or a fungal issue, we would clean up. So it goes beyond just rinsing in my mind and refilling. I think you really need to do a serious clean at least a couple times through the summer.
Okay, thanks for clearing that up for us. Jeff and Racine emailed us. He said that he just completely dug out a strip next to his driveway and to get rid of weeds and grasses. And in the process, he dug out about 100 crocus, daffodil, and hyacinth bulbs. He wants to know how he can keep those and when he should replant them.
Oh, there's two options, and they're both fairly easy to do, depending on how his project is progressing. But they can either be replanted immediately if he has a spot for them. But if he doesn't, what I'd recommend is either put them in a paper bag or on a tray and put it in a cool, dark spot, all of the bulbs that he's mentioned, and then plant them in October. The bulbs are ready to go for next spring. So again, replanting now or store them in a cool, dry, out-of-the-sun location. and then pop them in October, and they'll be fine next spring.
Yep, make sure that the ground's not frozen and you're good to go. Right. I always wait to the last minute.
We all do.
Yes, mm-hmm. It's terrible. Okay, well, we can go back to the phones. We have Bill in Oregon waiting for us. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a different trumpet vine question. I have some young plants. They're about a foot tall. I've grown them from seed, and I'm looking to plant them in an open area. I'm wondering what your ideas are to... I've read ideas about different stringing or building a structure around them, or you know, I want them to turn into a shrub. Or kind of a small tree versus some kind of vining thing. And I've read different ideas, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts on the subject.
Right. The trumpet vines, well, it's important to mention, and Bill, you're probably aware of this, they once they're established, once you get them in the ground, they're extremely vigorous. And as a woody vine, if you were to plant them at a base of a telephone pole, they would go up that and absorb the pole, in essence. So if your intent is to keep it smaller and train it to either a shrub, or I saw a beautiful one out at Longwood Gardens out in Pennsylvania where they had attached it to, in essence, along the side of a building, they had attached it to steel cabling, like industrial heavy supports is important. So, you know, despite the juvenility, you know, your babies here that you've started, anticipate an industrial structure that'll help dictate their ultimate form and be vigorous with snipping them back and guiding them. Unmaintained trumpet vines can become a thug and ultimately are extremely difficult to control once they get going. So I think getting a good start early is the way to go, and then, again, appropriate supports.
Okay, and good luck with that. Although, you know, when I hear vine, I'm thinking it's not going to be a bush. So, but it's interesting. You can train these things, can't you?
You can. It mm-hmm. won't stand alone on itself. Ultimately, as that trunk thickens, it'll have a little more support. But I've mm-hmm. seen them trained, and it's real interesting that they can be. And I think that's probably preferable to the telephone pole scenario, because they will will grow like crazy.
Okay, let's go to Paul in New Berlin. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
What's your question?
So I had a question about zucchini plants that I have, two of them. I did start them maybe 10 days later than I normally would, but they're, you know, big and vigorous looking. I harvested one zucchini maybe a week or so ago, and I just have no fruit on either plant. I have male blossoms, but a couple, and that's about it. And I have not done a soil test. I'm just wondering if you had any ideas of what could be happening.
Yeah, Paul, that's a great question. That could be a lot of different things. And ideally, in an ideal world, you would be pestering your neighbors with more zucchinis than you could ever eat. And
right.
Obviously, that's a goal for all of us. But back to my comments earlier on tomatoes, it could be your soil could be really good and your zucchinis are expending a lot of energy into foliar growth. But the fact that you did see some flowering and it did have some fruiting makes me think... again, it could be an issue with the soil, and ultimately, I think a soil test would be in order. If you've grown zucchinis in that same spot in the past and had success, I'd be even more curious as to why it's not occurring. So I don't have a real good straight answer for you, unfortunately.
All right. Well, thank you for the question, Paul. And we did have someone else who called, Kathy from the UW Extension, actually. She emailed about the trumpet vine blooms. She says carpenter bees have been known to do this. They're not able to access the tubular flower, so they slit them.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So maybe your insect thought was right on the money there, Mark.
Well, we'll have to do a little research. Maybe it's an oriole and or... carpenter bees. Yeah,
right.
Those bees can slice a lot of things. So.
Okay. Well, great. Let's go to Joya in Fitchburg. Hi, Joya. How are you doing?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've been a long-time listener. Listen, I am having a problem with my mums, garden mums, this year. They're about to bloom now, but some of them have the buds and they're getting black. You know, they're not blooming. They're black. So is this the Borealis or that bug you have on the peonies and other places? Or is it because of the high moisture it's not blooming? I don't know. And when is the best time to trim them back? These mums are about 30 years old.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I think, Joya, with again the weather, you hit on that. That could be an issue on why you're getting some blackening on the stems and buds. And I would take a sample in and have that tested and see what's happening. You know, the best time to prune them back, what we do at the gardens is we'll typically shear our mums in half in mid-June. So regardless of whatever height they are, we'll cut them in half. And what we end up getting is at that point, the stems will double. You'll double your flowering, and you have a more compact plant that'll tend to bloom a little later in the season, which is okay. The fact that your mums have had a 30-year run is amazing to me, so I think they'll grow out of whatever seems to be happening here, but you need to get a diagnosis pretty quick and see what's going on. I'd be worried that might spread to some of your other mums that are looking better.
Thanks for the call, Joya. Appreciate that. Janet in Marshfield, do you have a question for us?
Yes, I have two peony plants. Both have powdery mildew on one worse than the other, and of course the one that has it the worst has bee balm planted in front of it, which is real susceptible to powdery mildew too. So I was wondering if I should cut the peony bush off. I know it's early, and you usually don't do that till fall, but just to save the rest of the plants in the flower bed from getting that mildew stuff on them.
Right, and that's a good comment. And you're not talking about cutting peony blooms. You're talking about cutting the entire plant down. And I will say this powdery mildew is prevalent on all of the 300 peonies we have at the gardens. It's just that type of year. You can cut them down early. They'll just go dormant. It's a little earlier than I'd like to see, but ours, once they start really flopping and we see some yellowing on the interior stems when they've lost their stature, it's okay to cut them at that point. So most of ours are cut by early September at the gardens.
Is the mildew going to do any damage to the plants next year?
Well, what we like to do some sanitation in that, so we have a massive peony bed. So when we're cutting these down and they're all, again, mildew prone this year and having issues, we dispose of all that foliage off-site. We get it out of there. So the re-inoculation, the powdery mildew coming back each year will be an issue of the weather again, and it's not unusual, and it's primarily cosmetic. It doesn't necessarily hurt the plant except in the severest of cases. So it's tough to say. It's a year-to-year thing.
Okay, and thank you for that call, Janet. Let's talk to Ellen in Waupun. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is in regard to the Japanese beetles, and it seems we've had a real session of them this year. And with the damage that they've done to our crab trees and so on, I'm concerned that next year, well, with them multiplying, that there'll be more of them next year. And can a tree deal with that damage year after year?
And that's a great question, and it's really tough to predict Japanese beetle populations year to year because it's a condition of how the winter goes, snow cover. There's a lot of other factors that'll affect that population. So I have to say, based on experience, when we've had a bad year like we have this year, we usually have a couple years where it's not so bad. So I'm hoping that's the case. Your question about, you know, the idea of vigor being affected with these woody plants, in time, absolutely. In Janesville, Wisconsin, where I live, the little leaf lindens are every year are just nibbled down to nothing from these Japanese beetles or skeletonized. And they'll refoliate in a year, which takes up a lot of resources, and then that foliage is hit again. So we've had little leaf lindens suffer from low vigor and ultimately die over the course of, you know, a decade of this sort of nibbling. So the hope is, you know, with a lesser population in the future, trees do have reserves to get through some of this, but you're right on that repeated stress like this can have an impact ultimately on the overall health of these plants.
Thank you, Ellen. We're talking with Mark Dwyer. He is the Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Do you have a gardening question? Give us a call. We have some open lines. 800-642-1234. And let's go back to the phones and talk to Jeannie in Eau Claire. Hi, Jeannie.
Good morning, or good afternoon.
Yes.
I'm having a question. I have 7 apple trees. And along one side of one tree, there are about 5 branches where the foliage is all brown. And then I have one observation about the lady who observed the, I think it was a moth doing a slit feeding on a husk of flower. I recently saw
hummingbird do the same technique, and I had never observed that.
Okay, well, we've got lots of suspects for the slit. But what about that apple tree or those apple trees?
Well, I think sending in a sample is going to be important. What we're seeing with woody plants in the rose family, which include apples, crab apples, the mountain ash we discussed earlier, a lot of these woody plants are real prone to a lot of the same diseases, rust issues, fire blight, anthracnose. There's a lot of issues that it possibly could be. So I think getting a diagnosis, sending it literally to the lab, the diagnostic lab.
Okay, hopefully that'll work out for you, Jean. We had a listener, Sarah, on Facebook say that she has two varieties of salvia, and they are both done blooming this time of summer. But she wants to know, should she be deadheading them, and do you have any other tips to extend their bloom life?
Sure. I think we should differentiate between perennial salvia and annual salvia. And the perennial salvias, which bloom real strong in May and June, as soon as they start to lose color, and they still might have a little bit of blue or purple or whatever to them, butcher them way down. Take the flowers all the way down to the foliage. And what you'll get is a resurgence of bloom that'll go into July and almost till now. So if these are perennial salvias, it's still worth a try to deadhead them, because if we have a warm September, you still may see some rebloom. Annual salvias, you should be constantly deadheading, removing those spent blooms. And what you'll get is you'll get more and more branching. When I alluded to salvias in our Hummingbird Haven garden, we have about 30 different types of annual salvias of all different colors and sizes. We're perpetually butchering, to be honest, cutting these back. And the resurgence of blooms is unbelievable. And our intent is to have them look good all the way to October, because hummingbirds are still coming through and feeding in early October.
Okay, well, and speaking of hummingbirds, we've got a listener who has a story for us. Hi, Joe. He's calling from Abrams.
Hi. Thanks for taking this call. I had to call in with this story, okay? About a year ago, I'm walking from my house down to the road to get newspaper. It was about 5:30 in the morning. Certainly bright enough yet to see, all right? I had a hummingbird fly right past my face. He landed in a bush, burning bush right by the driveway. I walked a little closer. He dropped out of the bush onto the driveway and ran about 8 feet towards the mailbox.
Wow.
If you've never seen anything like that, they can run as fast as they can fly, for one thing. You do not see their feet. They move.
So okay? They can run as well as fly.
Yes. I just stood there. It was amazing. It was just one of these great bird things, you know.
Interesting. All right. Well, thanks for sharing that, Joe. Okay. Well, let's go back to the phone. We've got Dan in La Crosse with a question. Kind of happens to do with deer, but maybe we can help you with it, Dan. What's up? Dan, are you there?
Yeah, I just had a question. I'm just kind of curious on, I planted some apple trees this year, and I didn't want to totally surround them by my
fencing,
and so I had someone suggest to me that you can hang soap in a chunk of soap in pantyhose or something, and that the fat in the soap, especially Irish Spring, can deter deer from plants and from my apple trees. Is that true?
I think Irish Spring starts these rumors, because it's always Irish Spring for some reason. Mm-hmm. Have you heard that, Mark?
Yes, and it has limited results, and your deer population might initially be turned off by that. And we've tried it, by the way, at the gardens. We hung Irish Spring soap in pantyhose throughout an entire arborvitae hedge, and it worked for a couple months, and then I think the deer laughed at us and just pushed it aside. Keep in mind, with the weather and rains and the soap deteriorating, it loses, you know, I think its efficacy or its effect. I've also heard human hair. We've collected hair from area salons and put it in pantyhose and that scent. Ultimately, there's very little that will deter deer that are real interested in nibbling, particularly in the winter months. But I will say there is a product that we've had some success with, and it's called Plant Skid. And Skid is spelled SKYDD. So this plant skid has been extremely effective for us, and I'm not a spokesperson. I don't get a kickback for this, but it's not inexpensive, but we've had great success, particularly in the winter months, with browsing on evergreens, and I think it would have help protect your apples. But the soap thing, I think, would have limited results.
Okay. And we've got George coming up here from Green Bay. Hi, George.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. What's your question?
Well, we talked about vines, and something reminded me of Audrey outside. I have a 2-year-old wisteria that I planted to go up. It's now up about 18 feet up over the top of my deck, over the pergola. And we have to get out there and train it some more, which I know. What about wintertime? I have two questions about it. Would I be able to get it to reflower by deadheading? Would it go before against the seed pods? Is one question. And the other one is, how much can I prune it in the off season? That was pretty much the question about it.
Okay. All right. Well, seed pods, or getting it to rebloom, rather.
Yeah, the idea of deadheading it, once it gets to the seed pod stage, by removing those, you're not going to get a lot of reblooms. However, our wisteria vines at the gardens have had some sporadic reblooms without even doing that, and they're probably about 10 years old. I think more importantly, the thing with the wisteria is, and you've alluded to its growth rate, you want to keep it from going bonkers, and you can do severe cutting, and I encourage that. And if you've ever seen wisteria that's been on industrial structures like trellises or chain link fence, it literally embeds and absorbs the structures. It will work itself around. It grows faster than most people are aware of. But vigorous cutting it back is really the only way you're going to contain it. And ultimately, again, you just hope for a long bloom period of time. But I don't, again, think removing those seed pods is going to help with a longer period of bloom.
Okay. Well, have fun with that large plant. Mark, why don't you once again just run over some of the things that are coming up over at the Botanical Gardens in Janesville?
Absolutely. Well, we're at peak, so most importantly, people should come visit. So we're in Janesville, Wisconsin, 29 years of history, 20 acres of great gardens. We have a musical event on August 15th. We have an excellent plant sale coming up in early September. I did want to mention that next Wednesday, we have our third annual horticultural therapy symposium, and all I'll say is check our website. Registration ends Monday, but it's intended for gardeners and caregivers and those that are interested in how do we garden as we age, and it's the idea of raised beds, belly button gardening, you know, no-stoop gardening
sure.
opportunities,
mm-hmm.
sensory components, adaptive tools. There's a lot of great components to this event, which is next Wednesday. Our website's very current. I do a gardening blog almost daily, so it shows what's happening in the gardens. And, you know, that light show isn't that far away either. So I hope people will visit. We get about 100,000 visitors a year, and I feel we should have a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And we're ideally positioned right off of I-90. So for the folks that are listening that have always thought maybe I should go there. I think this is a year we haven't looked better. So come in the next couple of weeks if you want to catch a peek.
And what are your hours, which always surprised me?
Yeah, the hours currently are 8:30 a.m. till 8 p.m.
That's right.
We are entrance-based. There is a fee. We do have a membership program. But ultimately, it's a great way to see 20 acres of botanical splendor. That's the hope.
Perfect, perfect. We've been getting all kinds of great advice from our guests today, as usual. Mark Dwyer is the Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville, and I'm sure we'll have him back again soon. Thanks to our executive producer, Michelle Johnson, and to Dave Potras for technical direction. There certainly were the wind beneath my wings this week. Larry's going to be back on Monday to talk with computer specialist Peter Green. Hope you can tune in for that. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay with us. There's always more to come.